This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. It feels good to recycle, but what happens to all those empty bottles, cans and cardboard boxes once they get hauled away? To find out, I took a trip to the Orange County Solid Waste Division. It's to the southeast of Orlando, and it's where the county trash is piled onto a vast landfill, and it's here that trucks deliver loads of recycling to the MRF, that's the Materials Recycling Facility. It all gets dumped out for a visual inspection.
There's a lot of good recyclables. You know, there's paper in there, there's plastic bottles, glass bottles, but I know at this point I already saw a baby stroller in there. Unfortunately, people are just putting some of the wrong stuff in there.
That's David Gregory, Orange County Solid Waste Manager. We'll hear more from him in a minute. But first, here's the guy whose job it is to inspect each load and make sure it's fit to be shipped out to the factory that actually sorts out the paper, glass, plastic and metal. David Reed works for Waste Management.
So what are we looking at here?
Some of the items that disqualify this load for processing would be some clamshell items, which is non-recyclable plastic, some food items, metal poles, a lot of plastic bags, styrofoam packaging, non-recyclable plastic such as totes, TV stands, stuff of that sort.
I heard that there was a baby stroller in here too?
Yes, a baby stroller. Those are some of the items that if residents do not pay attention, that's what we get.
So what happens to this pile that's just come in?
We notify Orange County that this is a rejectable load, and Orange County notifies us what they're going to do with it, and then they handle the rest of it.
So most likely this is going to truck on over to the landfill and end up in there?
Yes, that's correct.
Which is kind of disappointing, right? If you're trying to run a recycling program, you want to make sure the most of that actually ends up going to the place it's supposed to, which is recycling.
Yes, it is. Not to mention it also fills up the landfill kind of quickly, too.
What's the craziest thing you've seen in a pile of recycling?
Front ends of vehicles, headliners, headlights, tie rod ends, a whole half of a car, some street light poles. Seen it all.
You saw half a car in a pile of recycling?
Yes, it actually was a BMW. It was the front grille and a headliner and everything else that came with it.
What ended up happening to that?
Unfortunately, it rejected the load, and we have to notify Orange County, and then they dealt with it from there.
So if you've got a BMW that's past its use by date, don't put it in the recycling bin.
No, donate it. Donate it. Give it to a worthy cause.
That was David Reed at the Orange County Materials Recycling Facility, or MRF. Now back to David Gregory, the County Waste Manager.
So what you're doing here is sorting out the good from the bad.
That's correct. Yep, trying to identify which loads come in that are suitable for further processing and which ones we're just simply not able to process because there's too much of the wrong things in them.
So what can you tell us about what should go into the recycling bin?
Sure. There are only five things that should go into that recycling bin. Plastic bottles and containers, steel and aluminum cans, glass jars and bottles, clean cardboard, and a clean paper. It's just those five things are the only things that should be put in your recycle bin.
And what are you seeing that's in there that shouldn't be in there?
Unfortunately, we can see just about anything that folks can fit into that 96-gallon container. We've seen such things as tires. Tires are unacceptable and can cause a load to be rejected. The biggest offending item that unfortunately gets put into the recycle bin is plastic bags. All of this material goes to a materials recycling facility, and it's a bunch of conveyor belts and screens and sorting materials, and those plastic bags can wrap around the equipment and gum up the work. So plastic bags, other garden hoses, stringy materials, those are our worst offenders and the things we see the most of and that are incorrect in the recycling stream.
Why are people putting that stuff into their recycling?
We believe it's because people are wish-cycling. They wish this material was recycling, so they put it into the cart. But unfortunately, if it's not one of those five materials, it can't be sorted at that factory where these materials get separated.
And you were saying before we got to the site earlier that when you guys move from the old small two-bin system to the big wheeled cart system, you ended up getting a lot more stuff in the recycling bins, right?
That's correct. What we saw when we went from the two bins to one single-stream cart is a significant increase in the volume of materials. We went from about 30,000 tons a year to almost 60,000 tons a year or more. But what we also saw is that those big carts are, I guess they must be inviting for people to put the wrong things in or those opportunity for things that never fit into that small 15-gallon bin will fit into the big cart. So that is where some of the challenges come in.
So you might think you're doing the right thing, recycling those bottles, cans, plastic containers and cardboard boxes. But if you put enough of the wrong stuff in the bin, it's not just your load heading to the landfill instead. It could be a whole neighbourhood's load of recycling that gets rejected. So to try and make residents a bit more recycling savvy, the county started a six-week pilot program. It's called Think 5, and the county's sending inspectors out to check individual recycling carts and give them a blue tag of approval or a red tag for try again.
How well advertised is that? Like, do residents know that there's going to be somebody sorting through their recycling on the curbside?
Absolutely. We put a mailer out to every resident. It's about 600 homes in our pilot area. And so it's a limited area, and what we're doing is we sent out this mailer ahead of time, first to let them know that we would be looking in their carts, and second to make sure we remind them what are those five items that they should be putting in their cart.
And that's David Gregory. He's the Orange County Solid Waste Manager. And now for more, we're joined by Dawn McCormick. She's the Director of Communications for Waste Management. Dawn, thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, good morning, Matthew.
And also joined by Professor Fazal T. Najafi. He's with the engineering department at UF, and he specializes, specialties include public works. Professor, thank you as well.
You're welcome.
You can join the conversation too. We're at 1-866-338-5252. Tell us your recycling stories. What are the things that you thought were recyclable but turned out they weren't? Or are you kind of interested in what happens to all that recycling once it gets trucked away from your curbside? 1-866-338-5252 is the number. Also on Twitter, you can reach out to us there at WMFE Orlando. Dawn McCormick, there have been some changes in facing the recycling industry in the last couple of years, right? One thing is that the destination for recycling is no longer so kind of assured. China has sort of said, well, we're not going to take as much stuff as we used to, or there might be a difference in the kind of things we accept. What kind of impact has that had on the recycling industry?
Well, there's tremendous challenges in the global marketplace for recyclables right now. China used to be the world's largest inbound recipient of recyclable material. They took 25% of the world's material, including over 50% of the paper and plastics that we were recycling here in the United States, as was Western Europe. China is trying to clean up its environment, and it's put very severe restrictions. They are no longer taking any mixed plastics or mixed paper, and even more importantly, they've put a very strict contamination rate of 0.5% of non-recyclable material in the bales they will accept. When you know that the national average in the United States for non-recyclable material coming into our plants is 25%, there's no way we can produce a bale at the end that's sellable to China or other markets at 0.5% contamination if the inbound material is at 25%. So we're really working with our customers, residents, and businesses around the country to recycle right. Only the material that's recyclable curbside.
I mean, we've been doing this for decades, right? Why is it difficult to get that message out, or why is it hard for people to grasp what should go in the bin and what should stay out of the bin?
Well, I think we've confused folks a little bit, and we all shared the blame a little bit. And again, folks want to recycle. As David Gregory said, there's this sense of wish cycling. Well, I think it could be recyclable. Let me put it into my bigger container that I now have. But that's absolutely the wrong thing to do. When in doubt, you're better off throwing it out in the garbage than trying to wish cycle. As David said, we really only want to see clean paper and cardboard, plastic bottles and jugs, and aluminum and steel cans, and in some markets, glass bottles. But everything else is garbage, including clothing, food, hoses and cords, and plastic bags and film. Plastic bags and film can be taken back potentially to a retailer, but they're just not recyclable curbside. And again, don't bag your recyclables. Put them into your container clean and dry. Absolutely no plastic bags and films in your curbside container.
We're talking recycling on Intersection. I want to hear from you too as well. We're joined by Dawn McCormick. She's with Waste Management, also Fazal Tinjafi with the engineering department at UF. 1-866-338-5252 is the number. Got a question about recycling, wondering where that material goes or what kind of stuff can and can't go into that bin. We'd like to hear from you. You can also reach out to us on Twitter at WMFE Orlando. Professor Tinjafi, the fact that China has kind of said, well, we're not going to take as much stuff as we used to, is throwing a bit of a spanner in the works, I guess, for the recycling industry. Are there other countries that are accepting materials where maybe some of the stuff that used to get shipped off to China can go elsewhere? Or is this forcing a major rethink for this whole industry?
I know that you want me to focus on your question, but personally, I believe very strongly that we have more than 67 counties in Florida, actually 67 counties in Florida, and more than 400 municipalities in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I think the Orange County should look into which one has the best recycling system.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of educational stuff attached to that. Also, California, there are so many counties. For example, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and other areas within the California state, very successfully doing recycling. About the customer, now coming back to your question about the China and other countries, I tell you, frankly speaking, we need to, or in other words, it's just from top of my head, is that we need to really dedicate some resources. I'm talking about real resources with the consideration and requesting from the federal government, state government, all has to really kind of coordinate and say, okay, there are so many developing countries that really need recycling
mm-hmm.
stuff. So just like old-timers, when the old clothes from the United States goes to poor countries and then resold on the market. But we were really sending them free.
Mm-hmm.
As long as the safety and health issue of the recycling product is okay, checked, then we can really send it to developing countries with the resources that we have. Instead of really saying that, okay, I'm going to help, for example, Afghanistan so much
mm-hmm.
money and so much stuff, you can send the stuff, take that money, send the stuff freely so that the people can use it.
Mm-hmm.
The issue of plastic is a very big one. California has really been doing great. They're going to the ocean and trying to, just like oil spill contingency plan, they also have a plastic contingency plan around the area mm-hmm. and they are doing cleaning. And I think that sort of phenomena from California point of view, I truly appreciate.
Right. Professor Fazal Tinjafi, talking about some of those plastic bag issues, I guess in some places in the country, they're looking at sort of outright bans of plastic bags. I want to get a call in here. Bill is calling in. Bill, what's on your mind thinking about recycling?
Great show. If we don't get any other takeaway, then just don't put the dry cleaning and plastic bags in recycling. You can take them back to the store. But the real conundrum people have is we're told not to put corrugated cardboard, the big cardboard boxes, into recycling, put those in the trash. And I think we're told to put the thin cardboard, the liner board, into recycling. I was wondering if your guest can explain the difference, because we're told people get mixed messages. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill. Appreciate your call there. Well, Dawn, I wonder if you could pick up on that. You mentioned that consumers might have been a little bit confused by some of the messages coming from the recycling industry or cities and municipalities telling people how to recycle. What about cardboard? I mean, do you have to sort out the corrugated stuff from the thin stuff? What's the best thing to do there?
No, actually, Bill, thanks for the question. Cardboard, all those boxes you get from online shopping, are some of the most valuable items to recycle, both from an environmental and an economic standpoint. So we want all your cardboard. You have to break it down so that it fits in your bin or your container. but actually all cardboard, all that paperboard in your pantry, all of that is recyclable, and the recycling centers want as much of that as they can get. So make sure you take out any of the material that's inside, any of the plastic or the polystyrene peanuts or any of the packaging material. That's not recyclable, but the cardboard is, and we want it.
There must be a lot more cardboard these days too, Dawn, with the rise in services like, you know, online shipping and people getting stuff off of Amazon and other places rather than going out and buying it in the stores themselves. Has that kind of changed the kinds of materials and the amount that is coming into the recycling facilities?
Yeah, definitely. We, have, of course, are seeing a lot more cardboard. And again, would I say we want that? What we don't see as much of, as you may guess, is newspaper. Not as many people getting a newspaper at home. But we're seeing more cardboard. We're seeing more plastics. And, we want your plastic water bottles and your plastic jugs, detergent, shampoo, and things. But all of those hard-to-recycle plastics, the smaller items, we're seeing more of that, and some of those are not recyclable. So if you're thinking plastic, think of bottles and jugs, and the rest of the material tends to just be garbage. So focus on the basics. I want to encourage folks in Florida to go to floridarecycles.org. That is the new Florida Department of Environmental Protection website. They have a great back-to-basics recycling message, and if you get on there, look at those simple materials, they'll really help you to recycle right.
Mm-hmm. I've got a question here from Brandon, who writes in on Twitter. In rural Virginia, we don't have a trash service that comes to our county. We had dumpsters for trash and sectioned dumpsters for recycling that were all clearly labeled and always full. Could we have these through the counties and eliminate the curbside recycling? Professor Najafi, I want to just come back to you. You mentioned the fact that, you know, throughout these counties in Florida, everybody maybe does it a little bit differently. Do you know, are there some places where there's no curbside recycling and people just have to take it on themselves to go to the landfill or the transfer station and sort it out themselves on the site?
To my knowledge, no. But what I really believe, I sincerely, what she said on the information on the site, recycling site, I think that information must be in a simpler form conveyed to the residents. The plastic is a big issue. I remember when I traveled all over the Europe, down there, I see people are bringing their own bag to grocery, and then they get their stuff and put it in their own bag. There is no plastic. Why can't we just do the same thing here? I'm surprised why in the world we don't learn from European experience.
That's what I believe. Professor Najafi, I think there are obviously people are being encouraged to bring their own bags to the shopping centres and take their own bags to the grocery places. I want to get another call in here, though. We've got Mitt calling in. Mitt, what's on your mind?
Hey, I'm calling out here in beautiful downtown Oviedo. How you doing?
Good, thank you.
My million-dollar idea is, of all these years we've been using plastic bags, why hasn't somebody developed a recyclable plastic bag? I mean, it's been forever they've been making them. I don't need a quality plastic bag. I don't see the cloth bag. When I go to Publix, I see some people coming in with cloth bags. Mm-hmm. Very few. It's kind of an aberration. I don't think America is just ever going to catch on. Some will. But you need to keep on putting this in people's face. And you know what the stores need to do? More signage, bring your bags. That's the solution. Because when you leave your car, you walk in the store, you left your bags in the car, most of the time you're not going to run back. Mm-hmm. But this, why doesn't somebody make a recyclable plastic bag? End of problem.
Thanks for your call, Matt. Appreciate that. Well, my understanding, and I'm going to throw this one to you, Dawn, is that you can actually recycle plastic bags. You just can't do it by tossing them into the bin, right? I mean, you can take your bags to a grocery store, and there's a kind of a place where you can put your old bags. Is that not correct?
Yeah, you are right, Matt. Again, plastic bags and film are not recyclable at your curbside program because when they get in combination with all the other material, they get caught in our machinery, they wrap around it, they shut our plant down, and workers literally have to crawl into the machinery multiple times a day to cut out the plastic bags and film and cords that get wrapped in the machinery. But if you take those very same plastic bags and your dry cleaning bags, back to a retailer like Target or Publix that accepts it out in front, they're able to single source that material, put it into a bale of just plastic film, and then that is recyclable through your retailer. So that's the message. Not curbside, but take it back to your retailer. And your caller made a good point. The first two R's are reduce and reuse. Mm-hmm. So we can reduce the need for some of these items like plastic bags if we bring our own bags shopping, or we don't need as many plastic water bottles if we walk around with a reusable bottle. So Lana, I always encourage folks to reduce at the front end. But recycling is the third R. There's a right way to do it to make it both environmentally and economically sustainable. These are challenging times, and we really need our residents in Florida and elsewhere to do the right thing and get back to the basics of recycling.
Got a couple other questions in on Twitter. Lawrence writes in, who makes money from municipal recycling programs, cities, companies, or both? Dawn, what's the kind of financial breakdown there? Where's the money coming from? Where's it going to?
Sure. In most cases, contracts are different municipality to municipality. But in general, if a private company like Waste Management is collecting and processing, we charge a fee to cover our costs. And then the commodity sales on the other end, there's a risk and a reward sharing. So if the commodity price that we can get for the material is higher than a processing cost, we share with the cities a rebate structure, a percentage of that profit. But for the last year or so, since China closed its markets, the value of commodities is down over 48%. So unfortunately, currently, some of the costs of just the basic processing are not being covered. Mm-hmm. So recycling is getting more expensive, and until the markets bounce back and we find alternatives to China, there are going to be some challenges. Only 35% of the materials that we currently collect curbside have a positive value. We have to pay someone to take glass. We currently have to pay somebody to take mixed paper. So the economics of recycling right now are very challenging, and we're working closely with our municipal customers to reset the market so it, again, stays economically and environmentally sustainable, which is what we all want to see.
Matt also writes in on Twitter, the new bins have misleading lid colors. I'm always catching myself about to put recycling into trash and vice versa. Dawn, I mean, just an observation out at the landfill where the stuff gets visually checked, it did seem like there's quite a bit of garbage in the recycling. I'm not sure if people are just throwing it in because they don't know better, or maybe they are getting confused. Is there some work to be done there to make sure that people know exactly what's going in which bin?
I think so. I think we can do a better job of education, a better job of labeling carts. And again, we believe 40 to 50% of people, 60%, really want to do the right thing and are just making some mistakes. But we are finding 20 to 30% of folks, unfortunately, are just using their recycling cart as an extra garbage can sometimes. And we've got to work with those folks, and we've got to educate them. And at some point, maybe the cities might consider enforcement. I do know some in Florida are starting to look at carts, and if we do educate and folks still don't want to recycle and are using it strictly for garbage, then I think we have to look at other avenues, because some folks just not wanting to do it right shouldn't ruin the recycling for their whole neighborhood, and that is what's happening. If you get enough contamination in a load, the whole load for the whole neighborhood's being rejected, and that's not good for the folks who are trying to do it right. So, again, education, trying to get everyone on board to do it right, and we're hopeful that will work and convince everyone to get on board.
Well, Dawn McCormick, Director of Communications for Waste Management, I want to thank you very much for joining the program. Also, thanks to Professor Faisal T. Najafi, Engineering Professor at UF, specialties include Public Works. Thank you both so much. Coming up next on Intersection, Puerto Ricans have been relying on hotel vouchers for accommodation. Got a reprieve this week, but only for a couple weeks. What's next for those evacuees? We'll hear that and more when Intersection continues in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Puerto Ricans have been relying on hotel vouchers for accommodation after being forced from their homes by Hurricane Maria got a reprieve this week. A federal judge ordered FEMA to continue the Transitional Sheltering Assistance Program until checkout on July 24th. Meanwhile, advocates are suing for more help. As of Tuesday this week, about 2,600 evacuees were staying in hotels in the continental United States and Puerto Rico under the TSA program. Advocates are also calling on FEMA to activate something called the Disaster Housing Assistance Program, which helps with things like first and last month's rent. FEMA says the Disaster Housing Assistance Program is inefficient and that it's working with the Department of Housing and Urban Development to provide more timely and cost-effective housing programs for survivors. One of the groups advocating for Puerto Rican evacuees is Faith in Action. Denise Collazo is the chief of staff, and she says it's been a chaotic and stressful week for those evacuees.
The families have been very much on a roller coaster. The weekend was particularly stressful because people were kind of getting mixed messages, and some people were getting word that they had assistance that was going to continue, and other people didn't. It was very, very chaotic, very, very stressful. I think right now the general feeling is relief for a few weeks until July 23rd.
And as you say, I mean, it's a couple of weeks, but that time is going to come around pretty quickly. So some people sort of saying, well, we don't want to wait any longer. We're going to see if we can figure things out on our own, or are they staying put for now?
Well, the folks that I've been working with most closely in Massachusetts, they're very, very well organized. There's a community of people that are working across many hotels and motels. And so they're organizing and they're working very closely together. Here in Orlando, you know, there's a number of groups of people who are working with the families in Central Florida as well. I mean, I think every family has to make its own decision, but at least the folks that I've spoken with up in Massachusetts, they want to kind of hold together, and they have already seen that by fighting and by raising their voices and reaching out to their elected officials and their city, state, and national representatives, change has happened. And so that always gives anybody hope in a hard situation.
One of the things that FEMA is saying is that if people want to make the trip back to the island, they'll be helped out with airfares and other assistance there. Have any of the people that Faith in Action has been helping out have said, yeah, we'll take them up on that offer?
Well, I think the irony around that is just the way that is. If I live in Florida, so I just find it really interesting that if I were to get evacuated from my house and I had to go to family member in Georgia and I showed up at FEMA and I need some help and they said, you know, we'll be happy to pay for your trip back to Florida. It's really kind of absurd. It's an absurd solution to the problem. Yeah, it's very ironic the way that they are approaching this. And our families are basically saying, we're here, we're making a choice to be here, we're staying here because our kids need medical attention, or we already have a job and the kids are just getting resettled in school where they've already missed some of them many months of school. And it's kind of like thanks but no thanks.
What is Faith in Action or other advocacy organizations able to do as far as kind of helping out with contingency plans? You know, say everything ends as far as the FEMA assistance in a couple of weeks when that deadline rolls around. Are there some plans being laid in for helping folks out with interim accommodation and other things?
Yeah, I mean, I think all of the organizing groups and the families and the clergy and religious leaders and unions and others that are working to help are thinking, okay, what is our plan B? And they're all developing their own plan B. But, for example, in Massachusetts, the plan, you know, a big part of their plan B has been, and it's been successful, that the state of Massachusetts is now stepping in to offer additional help to the families. And had the families not reached out and come together and organized, that would not be happening. And I think the same is happening here in Florida, where people are sort of calling out, asking the governor to use his power to reach out to President Trump or to reach out to Brock Long of FEMA and simply activate a program that exists that is designed to help with this problem. So basically, FEMA has the ability to end this unnecessary suffering. All they have to do is activate the Disaster Housing Assistance Program. It's called DHAP, and we're using the hashtag DHAP now. All they have to do is activate DHAP, and that can be a very, very good plan B that will help families take the next steps that they need to take to get back on their feet. If you were to imagine what it would be like to have lost everything you own, your home, your cars, all of your belongings, and have to move to a new place and start over, that process takes many years to rebuild.
What do you want people to know about the situation of these folks who are still relying on TSA assistance to kind of keep themselves afloat?
I just want people to know that I've talked to many, many of the families. A lot of the moms are very concerned because they have kids who have been already through trauma. You know, a family that I am aware of was trapped under a landslide for 3 days on the island of Puerto Rico before they were rescued. And then they've moved to New York and now to Massachusetts. And, you know, the children need stability. They need medical care. And the parents are working. Many of the parents have gotten jobs, even though they are, you know, maybe nurses or people with bachelor's degrees. They are working night shifts at Dunkin' Donut factories and things like that. So they are trying very hard, and they are taking all the steps that anyone would expect that anyone would take to rebuild their life. And it just takes time. And so we as Americans, we have the power to help solve this problem if we choose to do it. And so I think one thing I'd like for people to really understand, especially your listeners here in Florida, I'm based in Tampa, Florida, is that Governor Rick Scott has the ability to help solve this problem if he chooses to, if he were to ask the head of FEMA to activate the DHAP program, or if he were to reach out to President Trump. That would be very, very helpful to families who are working to take all the steps to put their lives back together after having lost everything.
Well, Denise Cliazzo is Chief of Staff with Faith in Action. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I also spoke to Republican State Representative Bob Cortez from Florida's 30th District about the plight of those evacuees. I asked if he thinks the TSA program should be extended further.
To me, that's not for a decision for me to make whether it should be extended. That obviously has been escalated up to the court level. And, you know, the judge has already decided not once but twice for two extensions. And if history serves us in Katrina, this happened over there too, and it got extended for up to 23 months. So I always knew that something like this was probably going to happen. And it's happening right now because we've seen in the past that this is how it usually works out. It will get challenged in court, and a judge will rule like it did in this past case of extending the help.
One thing that some advocates for these evacuees have said is they feel that Puerto Rico is being, or this disaster that struck Puerto Rico has somehow been treated differently from other disasters. I mean, you mentioned Katrina and the level of support that was extended from FEMA in that case. Does it seem to you, Representative Cortez, that Puerto Ricans aren't given the same kind of level of care and assistance that Americans in other disasters have been extended?
Well, Matthew, I believe that it's being treated different, but not in the way the advocates are saying. We're talking about funding in the levels Puerto Rico has not seen before. And then, trust me, I grew up on the island, so I've seen where Puerto Rico has never in the past received its fair share of federal funding. I'll give you an example with Sandy. New York, within 180 days of Sandy hitting the coast of New York, state of New York received $2.5 billion from the federal government. And we see even Florida with Irma has been receiving about $2.8 billion within the first 180 days. Harvey in Texas, Texas received about $5 billion within the first 180 days. Puerto Rico had received over $10 billion within the first 180 days. So the problem that we see is of maybe it not got there quicker than other places. You can't compare an island 1,000 miles away to the way it's in the mainland. The mainland, you can ship materials and product, truck, train, boat, anywhere, even plane quicker than you can get it to the island of Puerto Rico. In Puerto Rico, I was there within a week after the storm, and I got there barely because the airports had just opened. So the ports were not open. The airports were not open. That maybe slowed the process, but it was more of a logistic problem than getting the money there.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but Representative Cortes, have you made another trip or some other trips back to Puerto Rico to check things out since then, since the immediate aftermath?
Yes, I have. I was just there about 3 weeks ago. Correct.
I mean, what's the situation like there now? Because one of the things that FEMA is offering is help for people who want to return to the island. But obviously, if there's still kind of a level of devastation, that might not be an option for some folks.
What I saw in Puerto Rico is Puerto Rico is back open to business. The tourism portion of it, Old San Juan and everything else, is up and running and it's vibrant. So you're seeing a lot of movement towards the hardest hit areas, you know, the eastern, southeastern portion of the island. Yeah, that they are going to take some time getting there. My brother-in-law lives in my mother-in-law's house in a town called Doralo. And he's got blue tarp over his house. He's on a waiting list to get materials so he can fix his house. Nevertheless, he's got power. He's got water. He's living the structure as it is, somewhat damaged, but nevertheless, he's in this. So the island is being rebuilt. Homes are being rebuilt. And when we're talking about homes, you don't have the luxuries of HVAC or air conditioning and everything else over there. You know, household walls and a roof and running water and a gas stove would get you going. So obviously if you want more than that, then than what we have here, then obviously that's a different story and it costs a little bit more.
Finally, Representative Cortes, what are you hearing from evacuees here in Central Florida? And is there anything else that the state or local authorities can do outside of the federal help that they might expect from here on out?
We're doing it, Matthew, and I'll tell you why. When I mentioned this was a federal issue, the vouchers and paying for the motels to those families that are staying in motels is a FEMA issue. We in the state of Florida have no control. Our help is to try to help them transition. How? Get them a job. We can reach out to CareerSource. There's over 200,000 job openings in Florida. So those that are ready and willing to look for a job can. We have educational opportunities. The in-state tuition has been extended for another year in pretty much all the state colleges, you know, Seminole State College, Valencia, UCF. So you have the extension of in-state tuition here for those wanting to do. And housing on the FEMA webpage, it does have links for housing, whether it's in the Central Florida area or in the surrounding area. Those that had Section 8 can transfer their Section 8 from Puerto Rico, they're not going to find it in Central Florida. They're going to have to go to places like, you know, Northern Florida, Marion, or the West Coast and Clearwater, where they have some, and most of them are for seniors, you know, 55 and over. So then we're partnering with a lot of the nonprofits. United Way was offering to pay for first month, last month, and security deposit so these folks can transition into a hotel. Because whenever the court decides that they can authorize that the voucher program is going to end, these folks will have to find a place to live, whether it's here or returning back home to Puerto Rico.
Bob Cortes is a Republican state representative for Florida's District 30. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, my pleasure.
And Cortes says one thing Floridians can do to help Puerto Rico in its recovery is to take a trip to the island and contribute to its tourism economy. Still to come on Intersection, music from singer-songwriter Carly Jo Jackson. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Carly Jo Jackson is a South Florida-based singer-songwriter. In a performance that first aired on Intersection last July, Carly Jo Jackson stopped by our studios to perform Clipped Wings and Moving On.
could just fly away, I would, but I can't, so here I stand.
Listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're with Carly Jo Jackson. Carly Jo, thanks for coming back.
Thank you so much. Just to hear you say my name like that in your sweet accent, I'll be here.
All right. So you've performed some pretty big venues. You've played for like 60,000 football fans in San Francisco. You've played at South by Southwest. You play small venues.
Yes.
Tell me about some of those experiences.
Oh my gosh. The one you mentioned, the football one, gosh, that was crazy. Like, people, whenever they're in a big group like that, it's quite an awesome thing because you just the sound of that amount of people, and whenever all the focal point is even on you for one moment, it's like being underneath a burner or something. It's incredibly embarrassing and fun at the same time. It's like I'm addicted to that.
So moving on, let's hear it.
Moving on, let's play Moving On.
Hit me like a hurricane, yeah. Tore me up with every wave, and we tried to hold on and take the pain, cause I'm all for love. Picture perfect ain't everything. In the end, it don't mean a thing. And we had it all, but we gave it away. Mistakes were made that we couldn't change. I'm moving on without ya. I'm not at all about ya. I'm walking tall without ya. Moving on, moving on. Oh, I'm moving on without ya. I'm not at all about ya. I'm walking tall without ya. Moving on, I'm moving on. Oh, packed up and left your world, cause I ain't never been a callback girl, and a good love is all I prefer. Is that really too much? Yeah, you want me back cause you always do. Yeah, you'll change when I'm back with you, but you should know what you put me through. I'm all for love, but I've had enough, I've had enough. Moving on without ya. I'm not at all about ya. I'm walking tall without ya. Moving on, moving on. Oh, I'm moving on without ya. I'm not at all about ya. I'm walking tall without ya. Moving on, I'm moving on. Oh, 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 oh. Who's gonna give up? I'm not the one who's gonna go down. I'm not the girl who's gonna give up. I'm all for love. And I'm not the girl who's gonna give up. I'm not the one who's gonna go down. No, I'm not the one. So I'm moving on without ya. I'm not at all about ya. I'm walking so without ya. I'm gonna be fine without ya. I'm moving on without ya. I'm not at all about ya. I'm fine without ya. I'm moving on.
Kaylee Jo Jackson with Moving On. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I missed you very much, and I'm happy to be here. It's an honor.
And that interview first aired on Intersection in July 2017. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Our intern is Brenda Argetta. Find us on the NPR One app. Download the podcast from iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. And thanks for listening.